If you have a green thumb or have always wanted one, then get ready for Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, along with George Allman. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas, help solve problems, and keep you up to date on the latest developments in the nursery and landscaping industry. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and our guest, John Clements today. And we're going to be talking to you about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I am good.
People ask me that all the time. If we get a little rain, can I turn the sprinklers off now? And until we usually get three good storms consecutively, the ground is not, in fact, you'd find even after a deluge, if it was a quick shot of rain, you go out and even your mulch won't be really damp. It
takes a little time.
It takes a while to penetrate
to get down.
So about the third storm, and I say you can turn them off.
That said, I turned mine off, and not because I think I get enough water. I turned off because now it's cooler. There's a little moisture in the air. I will go out and manually turn on each zone as needed from now through the rest of the winter.
I did go out and adjust all the zones in our yard, backed them off, went from some of them that were going on 3 days a week. I dropped them down to two, and then just cut some of the durations down. I know half of our back lawn, the front of our house faces almost due south. It's a two-story house. Half of our back lawn just doesn't get any sun in the wintertime at all. So unless you cut the sprinklers back, it turns into a swamp back there. So
you could grow rice.
I could. if I wanted to grow some rice, we could do that.
You know, speaking of sleeved, I frequently tell people that it's very misleading to look at this tiny tree. In fact, I bought some a couple years ago from here that were literally test tube size.
Those were the citrus we were talking about. Right.
And I taught a citrus class here a while back, and a lady purchased a Valentine pomelo, which is one of my very favorite fruit trees. And she said that from that small sleeve that it was in, it has doubled its size since that class. So that's in a few months' time. So don't overlook the opportunity to get the cool stuff in the sleeves, people, because you put those in the ground, they will take off on you.
Yeah, they will.
And you save money.
You save money. And you get more unusual things that you can't normally get.
The citrus supply has improved dramatically over the past year, and the stuff that we can get and have available now is much, much better than it has been for years.
For years.
Started during the pandemic. There was a run on citrus during the pandemic, and a lot of our growers they ran out of stuff to sell.
And those that didn't run out found it difficult to stay competitive with the requirements from the state for quarantine to prevent the spread of the HLB disease.
One thing that I believe we got them back in stock again is the true dwarf citrus.
We did. We have three different varieties of true dwarf. We have Mexican lime, bear's lime, and a Washington navel's out there in true. Those are flying dragon rootstock.
Yeah. And we haven't had the true dwarf citrus for a number of years. I think the last time that we had it was when Monrovia was still growing it. And Monrovia has told us they will never grow citrus again. Between the state regulations in California for how they have to grow it to protect the crop from HLB, to the fact that it's not a crop that turns fast enough to make it really profitable for them.
Right.
So they are not going to be growing it anymore. But we did find another supplier that does have it. And you know, we used to get the Flying Dragon rootstock in just as Flying Dragon. It's a really interesting.
It's a neat ornamental.
It's a really interesting ornamental.
Right.
Very, very, very aggressive thorns on it.
They don't look like a regular, they look like a fish hook thorn almost.
And they don't have much in the way of foliage on them either.
No, it's mostly thorn.
It's mostly thorns. They do produce fruit, but it's completely inedible. I think it's solid pith inside. I don't think there's any there's very little or no actual fruit, edible flesh in it.
Right.
But from an ornamental standpoint, it's a pretty neat plant.
I think our Poway store has one out
here. We have one. We have one, but we can't sell it.
No.
But
it's ornamental.
It is an interesting.
From Four Winds Growers that you got that?
I think it was. I can't remember if it was. I don't think it was Four Winds. It might have been France.
Okay.
Might have been France. Evergreens had a lot of stuff available too, and they, as a lot of you probably know, Evergreen closed their. They sold their retail yards, but they still are doing wholesale. And as a matter of fact, they got stuck with a ton of citrus because their growing yard ended up in one of the quarantine zones, and they couldn't sell it. They had thousands and thousands of dollars worth of citrus.
Well, that's our fear as well, because for us, the quarantine zone is Poway Road, right. And we're just south of it.
It's getting close.
Right.
It's getting really close. So yeah. So it's at least at this store, it's kind of a balancing act of we want to have citrus in stock and available for everybody, but we don't want to overstock it for fear that if they do find another infected tree, then that will be the end of citrus sales at the store.
And then
we have to destroy the stuff that we have. We can't even get rid of it. So it's an unfortunate situation, but hopefully that's not going to happen. So we will see. If you'd like to ask us a question or have a suggestion or want to have a suggestion for the show, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. And remember, Anderson is spelled S-E-N, not S-O-N. And we did get an email from listener Margaret, and she said, "This past summer, I had a lot of anis butterflies on my dill. I loved watching the large caterpillars as they grew, but unfortunately, some were attacked and killed by ants. It was awful to walk out to see the large caterpillars that were alive and well in that morning, covered with ants. Made me sick to my stomach to see what had happened. The ants didn't bother the monarch caterpillars or the swallowtail larva on the citrus. What can I use to get rid of the ants? The ants have to go before I plant anything else in my yard. Thank you for your help, Anne." I don't know that I would be surprised if it was the ants that were actually killing the caterpillars. I think that they might be a secondary problem from something else that killed the caterpillar. My first thought would have been tachinid flies, going after the caterpillars. And then once they attack the caterpillar and the caterpillar dies
or is disabled enough,
then the ants move in and scavenge.
I would think that as well. I don't think the ants would get to the caterpillar unless it was hurt or killed from the fly.
Yeah.
Or some other cause.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't think there's any control that I am aware of tachinid flies in the garden. No,
anything that you would do to reduce their populations would be wholesale to kill everything else.
To get rid of everything, yeah.
And it's a dilemma because, frankly, I love tachinid flies to come to my garden. They're a predating insect.
Right.
That's going to help me with my insect control. So it's what do you do?
Yeah,
so,
what's the trick? Yeah, see, we had a ton of monarchs this year in our butterfly garden, and none of them survived to pupate into metamorphose into butterflies. Oh. They would form the chrysalis, and then the chrysalis would turn black, or the caterpillars themselves would get parasitized before they even had a chance to pupate. So
lot of times too, the plants that people are planting to attract butterflies are the very plants that also attract tachinid flies, and some of the ladybug larvae and things like that, like anise and yarrow and cilantro, gonda seed, Queen Anne's lace. And so it's a real dilemma because you're trying to attract two things that are essentially enemies.
Yeah.
But the ants are a bigger problem. I mean, clearly we have to deal with ants in the garden regardless of what happens with the caterpillars. But I think you're absolutely right. I think it was a scavenger issue after they were probably killed by tachinid flies.
Yeah.
After the fact, yep.
Yeah. as far as ant control is concerned, diatomaceous earth, you can use that.
Again, the taro makes a outdoor trap that the ants will go to and take the bait back to wipe out the colony.
Mm-hmm. And then you said Grangetto's
carries a product called KM Ant Pro Liquid Ant Bait. It's a little expensive, but it is listed for organic gardening, and it is used in commercial groves, orchards and groves, to help keep ants at bay.
That's often, Greg Rubin uses that quite a bit too. One of the things that will happen, even with your natives, you'll get woolly aphids down in the soil that will go after your ceanothus, particularly other native plants. And so the ant control for us is a huge problem. And the biggest issue is where Argentine ants are from in Argentina. They actually predate on each other. They have colony fight colony. But all of the Argentinian ants outside of South America think they're all one big colony.
So they don't fight.
They don't fight.
They're the same family.
And they keep themselves controlled down there. We do not have that same situation up here.
Right.
In fact, there is a great program on Radiolab on PBS from quite a few years ago that ground zero for the ant wars was actually just on the east side, or west side rather, of the 15 over on the other side of Lake Hodges, Eucalyptus Avenue, and I think Via Rancho Parkway. Because there was one colony there where they were fighting each other and they were trying to get this colony to... It's a great program if you ever want to Google that and look it up. But the ants are a huge problem for us.
Well, we know that's just in our fruit trees with them, you know, protecting and farming aphids and mealybugs
scale.
And scale. One of my persimmons, my coffee cake persimmon, every time I harvest, I have to shake my hands all over the place to get the ants off me. There are so many ants in the persimmon tree, but not for the persimmon. There's scale on that tree that needs to be addressed separately. But
well, it was interesting. I was talking to Jamie Ogle, who's the head of Lloyd Pest Control here in San Diego one time. And he was saying that one of their big sources of business was controlling fleas in people's yards. But he said once the Argentine ants moved in, the flea populations dropped dramatically because the Argentine ants predate on the fleas. So he said their flea control business dropped off quite a bit, but the ant control business on the other hand picked up. So,
right.
But we have not had, I can't remember the last time I found a flea in our yard. It's been years.
Yeah,
years
fleas aren't a problem like they used to be. That's absolutely right. And and in fact, up by Camp Pendleton, there is a road there called Rancho Las Pulgas. In Spanish, pulga means flea. And if you read diaries of people that first came to San Diego, the pioneer types, the first school teacher at Mason Street Schoolhouse, she talked about how godforsaken San Diego was. We all love it, but people hated it then. And she said the fleas would literally eat you alive back then.
Well, so, it was definitely not the most hospitable of places. Well, when you look at the landscape around San Diego and what was, you know, the city that we live in now, the area that we live in now, is dramatically different from what it was even 100 years ago, just because of all the plants that have been imported and planted throughout the city. So
I'm always struck when I return from the East Coast and how green it is back there compared to here, you know, much larger groves of trees. But then when I look at historical photographs of San Diego, it's completely different. It's much greener. There are more trees, there are more plants everywhere than when I look in a historical picture. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have change the landscape to make it much more pleasant than those people that were complaining about the fleas.
Yeah, that is true. And you know, if you want to see what San Diego looked like back then, just look east of the 15 at Miramar. I mean, that's basically what it was just, you know, some rolling hills and
chaparral.
Yep. which is interesting because you go up to Northern California and it's rolling hills and oak trees all over the place, both on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley and on the east side of the San Joaquin Valley. The Gold Country, Highway 49, it's absolutely beautiful rolling hills and massive oak trees all over the place. But we just don't have that closer to the coast down here. You get up into the mountains, you know, around Cuyamaca and Julian and that area, and it's quite nice, but the closer you get to the coast, there really just wasn't
much. The more barren it became?
There just was not much here at all at that time. So Margaret, diatomaceous earth, there are other chemical controls that you can use as well on the soil to keep the ants under control. But it's like we said, we think that it was probably the tachinid flies that got to them. And unfortunately, there's really nothing that you can do to control those. Just hope that the population in the area doesn't get so out of control that they go after
one other everything. Possibility. So one of the things that you'll find will happen, our ants they've evolved to survive flooding. And so what happens whenever we irrigate, you will see them vacate wherever there are in a nest in the soil, carrying all the eggs, and they will all look for higher ground. And this is actually from the evolution of all of the behaviors that they learn where they're from, that there's frequent flooding. So they have just devised this way to escape and then be able to continue life another place. And you'll see them all run up into your trees or high ground. So frequently what I will do too is I'll water, then wait for, you know, I'll just look around looking for nests that are evacuating. And there's a product called Spectracide Bug Stop that works pretty well. So once I see the nest, you can, and it comes in a 1 gallon container, and just spray the nest. And that's a pretty good control for at least getting the big populations. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I'll just irrigate an area to see where the ants are going to come out and then hit them with the Bug Stop too. And it's a little faster than the baits and things like that.
Baits are effective in that they take it back to the colony,
right?
But it's not quick.
Right.
And if you've ever used them in your home, you may have a small trail of 30 ants. You put the bait in, now you have 4 million ants.
Right.
Because they all come in to get it.
They
but
all
then
come in to get
a day or two later, they're gone.
So. Yeah, they do move on. So thank you very much for the email, Margaret. We do appreciate it. And like I said, if any of you out there have a question for us or would like to hear us talk about something in particular, feel free to email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. We would be more than happy to address it. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. I found a website called thehomegarden.com, and they had a Gardening 101 quiz on there that you could take. I don't know how often they change it, but I actually printed it out so we can test you guys. And I got 10 out of 10 when I took it, but we'll see what...
100%.
Yeah. It was pretty easy. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clement. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, David Ross, Mark Mahady, and George Allman.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with David Ross, Mark Mahady, and George Allman.
Well, I tell people all the time when they've gardened elsewhere, baby, you aren't in Kansas anymore. I mean, gardening here is not like gardening in Ontario, Canada, I'll tell you that.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I am sure.
Do you think it's, to stay on that train there, or anchor on that a moment, do you think it's harder here? I mean, it's very easy because we can grow all year round for things, but I think we have a larger pest issue than I had growing up back east where we would garden and work on the orchard.
I think we have bigger pest problems because the pests also don't
exactly
go to sleep,
that's my
right?
point.
So you have year-round pests. We have challenges of terrible soil most places.
Oh, really bad.
Just awful, awful soil. We also have, particularly for us in the southern part of the state, even LA has different water than we have. You can grow plants much better in Pasadena than you can in San Diego if you're irrigating, because we get the dregs. The worst of all the water comes to us from the Colorado River, and it's terrible for the plants. So we have a lot of challenges here.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, pest. I find the pest to be the most difficult, constantly battling something.
True.
There's always something. Right. There's always something going on pest-wise. I don't know that you can ever get rid of it.
I didn't have that problem growing up on an apple orchard back east. We didn't have as many rodents and, you know, everything just constantly stealing the fruit as I do here.
Now, did you have any fungus problems back there?
No, not really. I mean, you get apple scab, some coddling moths, but, you know, you'd spray early in the season and take care of it. But not like here. Here's a challenge. You're constantly, you have to be very vigilant here to be successful.
Yeah, that's one thing that I don't think we have a serious problem with. At least I haven't heard of it being a serious problem here in Southern California, is coddling moth.
It's really not a big issue.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's random, but it is here. Mm-hmm. We just don't have a large problem with it. I take apples off the tree without any hesitation and just start eating them.
Yeah.
Well, they've been having some wildfires on the East Coast as we speak.
There's one in Manhattan.
Yes. Yeah. And I remember hearing one of the news reports this week, and they said, we're having an epic drought. It's so horrible. And they said, we haven't had rain for 40 days. And I thought, 40 days? Try 4 months, 6 months, 10 months that we don't get rain. Yeah. And so for them, it just goes to the point that they get so much beneficent water that is so good. We have to irrigate everything. And when you think about they talking about having a drought, not having water for 40 days. And for us, we literally go most of the year without water.
And then we get our measly 11 inches.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when you think about it, our average rainfall is what, 13 inches a year, somewhere around there. I mean, that's nothing.
Yeah. That's why it's significant news when we have 30 inches or 28 inches or something in a given water season.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was listening to the radio on the way into work this morning, and they were speculating as to what's going to happen.
You're going to talk about what's going to happen this year, right?
Well, I'm assuming that's the weather pattern that we're in now. I don't know what to expect this year and see what happens.
Well, and San Diego's been cyclical for millennia, you know, and so one of the things about global warming people will talk about is, oh, well, gee, we have floods now. San Diego had a flood, so then they just attribute it to global warming. That's poppycock, because there have been regular flooding periods, you know, 1916, 1937, 1943, where San Diego River was bank to bank. I mean, across the entire floor of the valley. Otay River flooded and destroyed an entire town in 1916. So this is just the California pattern.
Well, it's one of the things that frustrates me about Sacramento is we go for a period of we get a rainy period, and then it starts to dry out, and we get into a drought situation, and they start to panic, and just as the panic really starts to set in and they start coming up with these draconian measures to save water, it starts raining again.
Right.
I mean, it's about a 4 or 5 year cycle. Mm-hmm. And it happens almost like clockwork. Mm-hmm. And it has for as long as I can remember. So I don't know what the answer is. It'd be nice to be able to save.
I think that is the
water.
Answer is, I mean, obviously homeowners and everybody with all of the, you said draconian measures, there are a lot of, you know, water on the, only 2 days a week, this amount, et cetera, and raising the cost of water to make it too costly to water. But I think the real answer is when it rains, capture that water somehow. And I'm not talking in your backyard 500 gallon tank, but statewide, more infrastructure,
more reservoir
to capture that.
Do you remember in 1991? So I've been involved in this business for so long. I can remember dry years, wet years, but 91, we were at the terminus of one of the worst droughts in California history. And it was just horrible. for like 89, 90, 91. And I had actually worked for some of the biggest water users, and they were publishing their name in the newspaper.
Oh, I remember this.
Yeah. Yeah. And Maureen O'Connor was mayor. Yeah. And it was Helen Copley, Joan Kroc, Linda Smith, who was Joan Kroc's daughter. So I'm working for like three of the top five water scofflaws, you know, and they're publishing here, and their water bill is $12,000 a month back in 91. Yeah, can you imagine?
That's a lot of water.
So anyway, hey, Capri, they were publishing and they were like ratting people out to each other. And then the Miracle March hit.
Yeah.
And it really took care of the water for like the next 5 years. And we changed cycles again. Yeah. So once you've been here a long time, you realize you're right, Ken. It's like this 5 year more or less cycle. And then there's like about a 25 year cycle of big floods. And that welcome to California.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to step on you, but I was telling Capri not to be angry with our water bill because we're always going to be pretty high with those 90 fruit trees. But if it's not 12,000, so we're okay. So going back to the oranges, though, there are pests that get into our oranges, right? That we there were going to touch on. And
well, you know,
you have a good story.
I have a great story. So I had a beautiful orchard on my home and on Tecolote Canyon, and I had terraced this thing out. I've got like 50 fruit trees back there. And my favorite of all of the Valencias is Midnight, which is great, seedless. And one thing about oranges too, in Japan, they have what they call a two-year orange. You can only do that with Valencias. And they will leave that orange on a tree for 2 years. And that is like gold.
Oh, really?
To have a two-year orange. They are amazing. I've done it in my own orchard. I'll just mark them and go, that's a two-year orange, and I'm going to wait. And it's incredible. But this beautiful Midnight Valencia, I go out my hill and I could feel eyeballs on me from somewhere. And I'm looking around. I have no neighbors. So I'm thinking, what on earth? And I turn around and there is the biggest rat you've ever seen. It's sitting in an orange, looking at me, fat, dumb, and happy, like the caterpillar from Alice in Wonderland, just going like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And I told him, hang right there. I went in the house, got something. And let's just say I took care of it.
You resolved the problem.
But I tell you what, rats are probably our biggest pest problem when it comes to veggies, trying to get them started when they're seedlings, citrus, all fruit. They'll go after pomegranates.
Oh, my goodness. I went and harvested a bunch of pomegranates about 2 weeks ago, and every third one I touched was empty.
Yeah. Now the rats get in there and just hollow them out. And you have to be on top of the rats all the time. And people will ask me, well, when can I take a break from the rats? And when do I reach a state of equilibrium? And it's just, they never.
Never. Yeah. In fact, I posted something on the San Diego Gardener Facebook page recently because people were commenting about their little seedlings being eaten. And everybody automatically defaults, oh, it's snails or slugs. Right. And it may not be the case. And rats and mice, and I've set up trail cameras and have video evidence of rats and mice eating, particularly brassicas. Mm-hmm. I've had them in the top of broccoli, just gnawing the broccoli down. In fact, next week, we're going to have Farmer Roy here. We should talk to him about his problems with brassicas. I wonder if he has rat problems up there.
Yeah, I'll have to ask him about it.
Touch base with him. But we have.
I think Farmer Roy's going to be here today.
For next week.
Oh, for next week.
Next week. but interestingly, I agree with you. The rats in pomegranates, in peaches, everything. They just climb up the trees and decimate.
Yeah. It was, I guess it's about 3 or 4 years ago, I planted in our garden, a pretty good stand of corn, and it grew like crazy. Mm-hmm. It was amazing how fast it grew, produced a bunch of ears of corn. I don't think I got 3 ears of corn out of it. I'd go out and every ear was completely stripped. Wow. They would climb up into the corn and just chew everything off of it.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah.
So I did a consultation. I do a lot of garden consultations and go out and give people plans for how to take care of things. So I had a client, they said, all of our things are getting mowed down. We put little seedlings out and then they're just chewed down to the nubs the next day. I said, you've got rats. No, we don't have rats. No, we don't. I said, yes, you've got rats. I can tell. And I can tell from your citrus trees, you've got rats. No, I think that was from a caterpillar. I said, no, it's from rats. You've got rats. So we're having a glass of wine, kind of post-mortem in a way. We're having a glass of wine. And they said, well, we just insist we have no rats. And so literally, sun's going down. And at that moment, two big rats run across the top rail of their fence. And I said, entered into evidence right there. You have rats. And so you have to keep up with them. And the thing with rats, too, they are brilliant. Do you remember Pinky and the Brain?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, I love Pinky and the Brain. You know, he's going to take over the entire world. Yeah. You know, visions of world domination. Rats could do it.
They could
do it.
According to Orkin, I saw this on KFI news site the other day. They published a list of the most rat-infested cities in California. We rank up in the top four. Ooh. San Diego. It's
That sound like a good thing.
It's not a good thing. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Sacramento, and San Diego. And wow. I would argue that a good chunk of those are in my yard. We are battling them constantly.
We used to see them in our yard. I just haven't looked at them recently, but we running along the top of the fence.
That's usually the big entry point, and especially if you're on a canyon or something.
Yeah, we butt up to a green belt.
Yeah,
so
that's what was my thing too. And the thing with the rats, they're so intelligent. They're so brilliant. Frequently, I'll get one in a trap, and if they see Uncle Bob, you know, in a trap, they just go, okay, whatever you do, kids, don't go near that. They have this way, and they will learn from each other. So what I find is I have to be on top of the game, constantly changing my methods of control, because literally you use a wood trap, I'll guarantee you next time that wood trap won't work. They also, when they get nailed in the trap, they let out a little wee-wee, and then it marks it. And then the other ones go, I smell Uncle Bob. He died right here. We're not going near that thing. So you have to begin to think like a rat.
That's interesting. I use the black tomcat traps.
Those are great.
And I leave them in the garden all year round so that they never get, and I just keep resetting them wherever I need them. I move them as necessary.
I must have smarter rats than you, George. And then it finally got to the point I would use the wooden traps. I would use the tomcat traps. We were using ratinators. And they're so smart, they will get off of that. So I finally, on Amazon, found these traps that look like medieval torture devices from China. And then they were all metal. And they were just really oddball looking. But then those worked for a while. Mm-hmm. And so I just find, just have in your arsenal, have enough stuff so that you can...
You have to have a deep bench.
You have to have a very deep bench to keep up on the rats. They're really tough.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You talk about the cities in California with... rat problems. Melanie and Blake and I were in San Francisco a few years ago, and we usually stay at the Hilton in the Financial District, which is on Kearney Street. And right across the street from the Hilton is Portsmouth Square, big park area. And one night we had been up in Chinatown for dinner. We were walking down Washington Street, which skirts along the side of Portsmouth Square. And as we're walking down the street, I looked over into the landscaping and the bushes. I've never seen so many rats. I mean, they were everywhere, and they were just scurrying all through the plants. I mean, there were dozens of them. And that was just the little section of the park that I could see from the sidewalk as we were walking along. I was stunned. I've never seen a rat infestation like that before in my life. They were everywhere.
Well, you know, John said that the people said we don't have rats. When I talk to customers and say it looks like rat damage, a great number of folks will say, oh, we don't have rats. We're very clean. I have heard that countless times since I've worked here. We're very clean. We don't have rats. Mm-hmm. I say, okay.
Well, for my kids, one of the most infamous incidents in their young childhood was back in the days, we used to have to drag the trash cans out. You know, they weren't the big... mechanical lifts. So I'm taking a couple of the trash cans out from the side of the house out to the front across the driveway. And as I'm doing this, two rats jump out of the trash can. They jumped onto me and then ran down my leg. And my son still to this day says, oh my gosh, Dad, I remember when you were just screaming like a girl and flailing all over the place. So people just, that's one less thing you have to worry about is rats in the trash cans these days.
You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, David Ross, Mark Mahady, and George Allman.
And we're back. With more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ, I'm Ken Anderson along with David Ross, Mark Mahady, and George Allman. Well, actually, you know what? Since Roy is here, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about what you do, Roy?
Well, for the past 14 and a half years, I've been the director of horticulture at Poway Gardens in Poway, California. We're off Monta Vista Road. We're a memory care community. We're 30 plus acres. We have all of our residents have Alzheimer's or some form of dementia. Mm-hmm. And we utilize horticulture to enrich their lives in many ways. And we also run a food bank garden that's run by benevolent volunteers in the Poway area. They come every day. They work in the garden. They raise about 8,000 pounds of produce for families in need in the Poway RB and Rancho Penasquitos area. And we have, in our little gardens, we have five little gardens, roughly 40, 50-foot rows, where we grow constantly fresh, organic, nutritious produce for our residents' dining pleasures. And we'll do about 25,000 pounds a year. We've been doing that for a while, so that's encouraging. We're on the right track.
So the 25,000 pounds, that's in addition to the 8,000?
The 8,000 is a total separate entity that goes to families in need. The 25,000 that I grow in my gardens, which is still on the same properties, goes to our kitchen.
That's amazing.
And we use it for promotions and freebies for Looky Loos and people that tours and things like that.
And that's all year long, right?
All year long. Right now, yeah. Yeah, all year long.
Well, I know during tomato season, you're kind enough to bring in tomatoes for us.
Sometimes not even tomato season.
It is still tomato season. And the tomatoes that you guys grow are just absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. I was a commercial grower in Baja for 20 years, and I've tomato juice runs through my veins.
Well, you had told me one time you were involved with the with Celebrity Tomatoes, was it not?
Yeah, Celebrity was named on our ranch. Our ranch in Baja was right next door to Pito Seed Company seed production place. And you know, you were in the world of tomatoes, you're always looking for the best tomato. And so I had a lot of contacts with all the seed companies because I spoke English, and we were at the cutting edge of all the trialing of varieties to sell to the public, for the seed companies to sell to the public. And Celebrity was named after we did some trialing on our ranch there, and it's still a really awesome variety. There is a new improved version of Celebrity, with probably better size. I don't know. I'll find out. My go-to variety of tomatoes, I can't get the seed anymore. So I'll be getting to start trialing new varieties for next year. But yeah,
what was the go-to tomato for you previously?
The variety from called BHN 1021. That was for my early seed. We'll grow like 500-600 tomato plants a year. And that's of the 25,000 pounds of produce we kick out, about half of that's tomatoes. So, and that was just a great variety in the spring here. And so just a key for you folks that buy seeds online. I used to get the variety from Johnny Selected Seed, which is a very reputable seed company. But all of a sudden they discontinued that variety, and I had to look at other sources. And then I went and made the mistake of getting supposed BHN 1021s from Amazon. And I don't know what the hell that variety was. It was actually a mixture of varieties. All of them were horrible.
Mutts.
But we'll still have plenty of tomatoes.
Now you're growing operation in Mexico. Is that down in the San Quintin area?
Or? That's where we started, in San Quintin. I married a farmer's daughter. I went to school at UCSD and worked at the bookstore. And there was a lovely lady that worked in our offices there. And she said her father was looking for somebody with a little science background. And I loved Baja. That's when it was really awesome.
Back in the day, San Quintin. I've been fishing in San Quintin since like awesome. 1970. And awesome, awesome sport fishing. Yeah. Isla San Martin and all the big yellowtail.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I did a lot of fishing. And then we ended up pioneering in other farms all the way down to the La Paz area.
Really?
So, and we had a small plane, so we got to land in little spots and do some fishing that you only can dream about. So
your background in science wasn't in agriculture. You were a math guy.
Math and economics and drama.
The drama is starting to make sense. Okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. Marine biology too, but yeah, I have a love for science and math.
I try my best to live a drama-free life.
So it's brassica season now, but if we could touch on tomatoes for a moment, because you have some, and you mentioned your favorite for the early season. What do you transition to throughout the growing season?
We use a variety called Mountain Fresh, also from Johnny's, which gives you use size. I mean, I'm holding that's a good amount of 10-ounce or 9-ounce right now.
That's about the size of a baseball.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it just gives really good size. It doesn't set nearly as much, but they're big, fat, beautiful tomatoes. I've won tomato contests with that one. And they're delicious. Our tomatoes are delicious.
They are.
I don't know what I'm doing, because when you're a commercial grower, that's the last thing that of importance. We don't care what they taste like as long as they're big and they can make it to Boston. We're happy.
Yeah. And as I recall, you and I were talking about tomatoes one time a while back, and you said you typically grow determinant varieties.
Determinant as opposed to indeterminate.
So yeah. You get the crop, you get it over with, and you get it out and start something
else.
And
we do successive planting. So we incorporate that idea of successive planting throughout the growing season. I used to start in mid-January, and after getting nipped too many times by frost, I just threw in the towel. And somewhere around February 15th, March 1st, we'll start with our first ones. And just a word to the public, that's when you want to get your first tomatoes in. And then somewhere around April, we'll plant more, and May we'll plant more. And then I hit the gardens hard in June and July to give us a nice flurry of tomatoes at the end of the year, striving to have caprese salad for Thanksgiving dinner. So
very nice.
We won that one this year.
Nice. Very cool. Yeah, those are gorgeous tomatoes.
Yeah, they're good.
Hey, Roy, you have to plant in the same beds.
Yes.
Right, because you're not moving your crop. And so conventional wisdom is that you don't plant Solanaceae like tomato in the same area. So how do you get around that, preventing nematodes and such?
So, yeah, that philosophy of not planting in the same spot is because of nematodes. Nematode is a microscopic wireworm that just rampant. And if they're like rats and you got them. If you've been gardening in your garden, you have nematodes. They're there. And so when we plant, we apply beneficial nematodes. I go to Walter Anderson's little refrigerator there where the ladybugs are. And I apply the beneficial nematodes at planting. And then I think the real key is to use nematode resistant varieties. Yeah. And so, does that mean you will never have nematodes by using? No, but you will get a crop. You will get a crop. And the story I tell people in my classes is one year somebody gave me a bunch of tomatoes called Delicious. They were, I don't know, sounded good. And I planted a row, 63 tomato plants in that row, and I did not get one tomato offer.
Oh,
and
wow.
Then, so I pulled them all out. And then I put Celebrity, which is a nematode-resistant variety, and I got like 1,000 pounds out of that.
Wow.
So I tell people to use the beneficial nematodes, but try to stick to nematode-resistant varieties. The only area in our gardens, we have an intergenerational garden club where we have local homeschool kids and preschoolers that come work in the garden. They learn two things. They learn how to garden, and then they learn the benefits of volunteering, because then we get together with our residents, their grandmas and their grandpas, and then we do activities for the rest of the time there. But we'll put cherry tomatoes in our children's garden. We put like 48 plants in every year. We put like 11 varieties in there. And then, so the greatest day of the year for the kids is planting those. The second greatest day of the year is somewhere in July, where we have our annual taste test. Mm. And I'm sure Cornell would turn their nose up to the panel of judges that we use, but it's hilarious and it's fun. And if you've never grown tomatoes and you're trying to get your kids to enjoy vegetables, cherry tomatoes is a great start.
Excellent. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements and our special guest, Farmer Roy from Poway Gardens. And we've been talking about the incredible job that you do growing vegetables for Poway Gardens and also for the bank. Or for the food bank. And we had just got through talking about your process for growing tomatoes. And what are you doing now? What's
right now we're planting every week we plant again, we have roughly 40, 50 foot rows. Every week we plant three rows, roughly, sometimes two, sometimes four. And every week we, at this time of year, we plant broccoli, cauliflower. We plant twice as much broccoli as we do cauliflower because cauliflower is huge and heavy and big, and broccoli, everybody loves broccoli. People should really enjoy cauliflower though too. And then we incorporate lettuce in between all of our plantings. And so that way, 4 to 5 weeks down the line, we have lettuce every week for our residents. And then somewhere between 65 to 90 days, we have broccoli and cauliflower from those rows. And that just keeps going. That's, again, it's the whole idea of successive planting.
And successful.
If you're successful. Yeah. And we just keep going. And we have we also add cabbage, bok choy, snow peas, snap peas, things like that. So we have a new head chef right now, and he's... I just say, hey, you want to sit down and talk about, you know, what I can grow? And he said, just bring it. Just bring it. We'll use it. So I love that.
So, now, do you start everything from, well, you don't start everything from seed because you get stuff from us.
The only thing I get from you guys is lettuce because it's uniform and I know exactly how many I need so I can purchase that many. And, but everything else we do by seed. And so again, in our hort therapy program, classes that we offer our residents, they in one way or another have touched every plant that goes to my gardens and to the food bank gardens. So it's kind of hard for 80-year-old ladies with Alzheimer's to seed broccoli. Seed's pretty small. Mm-hmm. I can barely do it still. But you know, all the bigger seed stuff they do. But then we seed trays of like 128 cavity trays of broccoli and cauliflower. Again, every week we seed X amount. And we take them out of the trays after about 3 or 4 weeks. And then we put those in 6-packs with potting soil. And in about a month after that, they're ready for the garden. So they've touched and been with everything that we grow. And then when spring comes around, they're very adept at seeding squash and things like that.
Yeah, I'd love to find out about what you start with in your beds. First, the soil, what mix are you using? And then secondly, every time you plant, because you're very intensive, mm-hmm. what are you doing at planting time to replenish your soil, you know, compost, fertilizer, that kind of protocol?
You're a master in the world of gardening, and you've touched on probably the most important thing in your gardens, and that's soil prep. Preparing your soil for planting. And it doesn't matter if the row that I'm ready to plant is broccoli or tomatoes. It receives the same amount of love and the same attention. And we apply four things. Compost, composted chicken manure, worm castings, and then probably the most important thing after that, the fourth ingredient is some pre-plant fertilizer, balanced pre-plant fertilizer, like a 4-4-4 or 5-5-5, organic, of course. If it's 15-15-15, you're off the grid and we don't talk to you because that's that's conventional. The plants will grow really well. But those four things, without even thinking, that's every. And so again, in my 40, 50 foot rows, every row will probably have about three different looks to it throughout the course of the year. Maybe a broccoli in September, cauliflower in November, and tomatoes in February, something like that. But that gets, and we've been doing this for over 14 years. So even our crappy, can I say that? It's soil, soil in Poway, our beds are, I think they're pretty juicy. So,
and you're in ground beds, not raised beds.
No, in ground.
Yeah,
in ground.
We've toured it and it's a interesting thing to see and it very productive. Everything just, oh, and what about spacing? There's a, you know, intensive planting, but how about how close do you plant your plants?
Yeah, so all of our rows, we to irrigate, we use drip tape. So if you can imagine a bed that's like roughly 18 inches wide, a few inches tall, and it's got a tape down the middle that irrigates every 8 inches in a very uniform, precise manner. And so we get a beautiful wedding pattern. So things like broccoli, cauliflower, we plant at 18 inch. Everything you want to plant in your garden, there's a plant habit and plant spacing that's always recommended. But our broccoli and cauliflower, we do 18 inches on both sides of the tape in a zigzag fashion so that when they grow, it just makes this beautiful hedge. And 18 inches there. And then if I have a 50-foot row, I can usually get like 67 head plants of broccoli in it. So then we immediately come back. We go to our friends at Walter Anderson's and pick up lettuce. And then we'll put lettuce at 50% of the population of that row. So every other space, I'll put a lettuce. You could do it. Everyone, but that would be, the kitchen would kill me. That's just like way too much lettuce. it's just a formula. We just, we know that like after we plant the lettuce in that row, if it was planted roughly at the same time as the broccoli and cauliflower, about 45 days into it, we'll get a nice head of lettuce. It's all romaine. And then that gives us a chance to get those out, take the weeds out and do an additional fertilization if necessary.
Do you fertilize the plants after they've been planted for a while?
Depending on what plants is. This time of year, broccoli and cauliflower, if it is a 65-day variety, somewhere around day 45, you're going to get excited that if the gophers or the rats haven't eaten it, you'll start to see a little head forming in the middle of the plant. So then we follow with a high shot of nitrogen to kind of really kick it in the pants and try to get the biggest head. I mean, you're striving for the biggest head you can get because you're only going to get one head of cauliflower, and a big head of cauliflower is better than a little head of cauliflower.
What's your nitrogen go-to? Fish emulsion, or what do you use?
I tell people to use fish emulsion. It's a 5-1-1, and it's super easy to apply. So if you take the weeds out, take your lettuce out or whatever's in there with it, get it out, clear it out, and lay that, and then a little shot of water and work it into the soil. And they give you a chance, too, to if you have any aphid problems, it's a good time to put a little spray nozzle on your hose and just give a nice heavy shot in the middle of the plant to blow off anything that might be hanging around there.
Speaking of aphids, what is your water. Go-to pest control? Water?
Water.
Just blast them off?
Well, right now, we're transitioning from warm to cool season. Mm-hmm. So in a couple months ago, a lot of the crops that we had were covered with black shade netting to keep the 100-degree temperature off the plants. And then, but now we're putting a white floating row cover to give more heat to the plants as we dip into the 60s. And we'll keep that on there for the first 2/3 of the life of the growing of those plants. And so I think we're getting a really good insect control with that. But water is good for aphids and if need be, insecticidal soap that you can get at all of your friendly nurseries.
Interesting. I would think that aphids and broccoli are
aphids and cauliflower. Like I brought a beautiful head of cauliflower and I had to rinse it off.
but Brussels sprouts are the tough one for me.
Yeah. You know, people ask me about growing Brussels sprouts and yeah, we all love Brussels sprouts in November and December. And the only drag about them is they take like 120 days. Yeah. And I thought,
oh, it's a long
time.
And then they get so dang tall. How are you going to cover them? And then, yeah. And in San Quintin, where I was growing tomatoes and strawberries, if you didn't grow tomatoes and strawberries, you were probably a Brussels sprout grower.
You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCPQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman, John Clements, and our special guest, Roy Wilburn. We'll be back next week with another hour of Garden Talk. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for joining us on Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, your source for gardening, landscaping, and horticultural news. Still have a question for the Garden Talk crew? Or want to learn more about the show or how to become a guest or sponsor? Send an email to gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. That's gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. Or visit walteranderson.com. There's more professional gardening advice next week at the same time on Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery.